This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Informativo has come to you on digital transcription. This is WBAI in New York City. Good morning, come on.
Hello, my name is Judy Gorman. Please come to a benefit concert for WBAI on Friday, July 17th at 7 p.m. It'll feature myself, Judy Gorman, the Ray Corona Band, the Mahina Movement, the New York City Raging Grannies and their daughters at the Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church at 85 South Oxford Street in Brooklyn. Please join us. That we can do.
Change for once in my life. It's gonna feel real good. Gonna make a difference. Gonna make it right. As I turn up the collar on my favorite winter coat, this wind is blowing my mind. I see the kids in the street. But not enough to eat. Who am I to be blind, pretending not to see them eat? A sonorous disregard, a broken bottle top, and a one-man show. They follow each other on the wind and know It's gonna feel real good. Some more.
Change.
Just live yourself. You know. You got to stop it. Yourself.
Yeah. Make that change.
I gotta make that change today. You got to stop. Make yourself.
For a benefit concert for WBAI
on Friday, July 17th, 7 p.m., featuring Judy Gorman, the Ray Corona Band,
Mahina Movement,
and the New York City Raging Grannies and their daughters.
We'll see you at Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church, 85 South Oxford Street, Brooklyn, USA.
Help save our most progressive radio station.
To be free.
I am the daughter of a bastard race.
Is that it? Which one of them is us? WBAI, the progressive radio station, or something born of a bastard race? I don't know. My name's Bob Fass. This is Radio Unnameable. That's Bill Prop over there, the stellar Bill Prop. And Ray Corona is with us.
Well, hello
to you.
Hello.
And Ray is not going to stay for the whole night, or maybe he is, but Paul Krasner has agreed to join us by telephone.
Yippee.
I'm expecting a call. Speaking of yippee, I'm expecting a call from Ed Sanders as well, who is going to talk about the benefit for Thule Kupferberg, who is improving faster than anyone dared to hope. He's able to see colors. He had a stroke, as you may know, and he lost his visual perception. And he's coming along. He's regaining his ability to see colors, and I understand he went out dancing last night. So he's a strong fug. Strong fug guy. And we all love him and wish him great and continued health. He's one of the best songwriters in America. He had a Grammy award, I believe, for Morning.
I think so.
Morning. And now that we haven't got Michael Jackson, we got to treasure our other musicians even more. And welcome.
Should I tell people about the exciting musical event that's coming on Sunday? Because
well, didn't we just tell them through those carts that you gave me?
Well, no, that's the WBAI benefit in July. But this coming Sunday, there is an opportunity to really get together with a whole host of musicians that are probably favorites of many people listening to the program. One of the best known is that tall guy with the banjo, Pete Seeger. He will be there, and so will many others. There's too big a list to even list them all. I can give you a rough idea. It's a variety of different styles. Our band will be there, the Ray Corona Band, and we'll have with us Chris Lang, following with his musicians, and Emma Graves, and the many other groups, the Raging Grannies. And you can find out who they all are from the website and get details of where to go. So I'll give the information, and I'll also give the website for people that aren't real fast with their pencils and pens. So the information is that this is all happening on this Sunday from noon till midnight at Pier 66. There's a place called the Frying Pan at the end of the pier that overlooks the Hudson River, way out into the river. And the festival is an environmental and music festival. Pete Seeger thought of the idea himself. He said that it really should be something to connect activists back to the river in the city and back to some of the environmental causes, and that maybe this could help do it. So, and it's also dedicated to Carl Schwartz, who you may know, who is one of our fallen activists. He had been a great mainstay for the New York City Friends of Clearwater for many years, and unfortunately we lost him a little over a year ago. So anyway, back to this festival. It's you go over to 12th Avenue and West 26th Street, and that's where the pier begins. Walkway
this
out.
This is in Manhattan.
In Manhattan.
Our listeners out there along the web, if you want to start out now, you can probably get there by Sunday. There are people listening in New Mexico who
yeah,
might want
and
to
you
come
know
to
what,
that
what,
event.
I have exciting news for them. The whole thing is going to be videoed by the Good News Broadcast people, and then they'll put it up on the web, so no matter where you are, you can see it in the future. The other good news is if you can get there, the entire day is free. It's all free music, and it's going to be really wonderful, I think. And so about that website, in case you forget what I said or you want to find out who all the other people are, go to you don't even need the three W's. For some reason, they get very direct here. You just, right after the HTTP and the colon and the funny slashes, you just write nycfriendsofclearwater.org. Just write that all together, nycfriendsofclearwater.org. And that will get you to the Clearwater website. At the bottom of the page is a big logo that says Water Festival. Click on that, and then you're ready to go. So we hope that maybe we'll see some of the listeners out there. And it's going to be also a lot of mixing up, I think. There are speakers. There are different kinds of artists there. There's going to be some film. There'll be visual artists. There'll be lots of fun things to do. It should be a very, very interesting day. And if the weather holds up, it'll just be a wonderful day on the river.
That's a wonderful place for a party. I've been to a few parties there previous years, and it's wonderful. There's a place for a band, and if you don't want to listen to the band, you can go out of earshot, practically, of the band. I know that may be upsetting to you, but some people who want to talk and want to just, you know, climb up the ladder into the steering house and look out and imagine that they're Humphrey Bogart in Key West or something like that. I mean, it's a great environment.
And that's actually, we don't mind if they have a spot where they can talk, because then we can play where we are and the people that want to listen can hear. So everybody can do their thing. They can do what they want to do.
Usually great food.
They do. They have food there. And
and it's a family way, friendly.
Absolutely.
And it's a way to support your favorite progressive radio station, WBAI. So I don't know whether this guy is going to be there, but we'll ask him. Are you going to be there? Yes, he says he will be there, but we won't let him on the boat. Don't worry. That's an obsessed guy, you know. Obsession. Where would the world be without it? If Einstein hadn't been obsessed, if Freud hadn't been obsessed, if Tim Leary hadn't been obsessed, if Albert Hoffman hadn't been obsessed, if Abby Hoffman hadn't been obsessed, if Paul Krasner hadn't been obsessed. Obsession is Allen Ginsberg, definitely an obsessed guy, right? And some of us around here, I think we're pretty obsessed, too. And we're going to keep this radio station alive, and we'll be kicking again soon. I mean, I guess we're kicking a little bit now. But I would like to kick off with a little music. Would you play
Okay, I was thinking it might be fun to do this song. I've known Pete Seeger for quite a while. We've played together. We've written, recorded together. And I really love the guy, but I find that it's very difficult to compliment him. He doesn't like people to put him on a pedestal or even just to be a little bit too gushy
about
anything.
Well, it's hard to describe him without complimenting him.
I know. So I wanted to write a song and get away with that. I wanted to come up with a song that I could honestly sing, and I would have no apprehension singing it right in front of Pete Seeger, but at the same time that would really capture a lot of what move me that the man has stood for and done, and many other people. So maybe we can see whether people think this did it. Here's the song. Sometimes the world can bring you down, with war and injustice everywhere. But you do all you can do, and to help you make it through, there's nothing like a song you can share. Just pick some words people can repeat to add some rhythm. Tap your feet, find a part that makes your voice sound sweet. Now sing like Pete. Great silver river in the sun, deep blue under stars when daylight ends. Keep our waters pure and clear, don't let trash or toxins near. Then go out on a sail with your friends and pick some words people can repeat to add some rhythm. Tap your feet, find a part that makes your voice sound sweet. Now sing like Pete. Changing the world's a major job, takes more than some people at the top. But through struggle, work, and art, we'll each do one small part. Keep singing, don't ever stop. And pick some words people can repeat to add some rhythm. Tap your feet, find a part that makes your voice sound sweet. Now sing like Pete. Pick some words people can repeat to add some rhythm. Tap your feet, find a part that makes your voice sound sweet. And sing like Pete.
Well, I like that. Thank you, Ray. Thank you. And I want to make a suggestion.
Yes.
Okay? Once or twice in the history of this program, I've had sing-alongs with the people in the audience. And if there are people who would like to sing along on some song, everybody knows, like Michael Jackson's Thriller She's Like a Rainbow, the Rolling Stones, or maybe one of your songs that you could suggest. Probably you could suggest a better song that everybody knows, or one of Pete's songs.
Well, one that he liked to close a lot of shows with was This Little Light of Mine. It's an easy sing-along.
That's great. That's right. Okay, if you would like to audition for the Radio Unnameable Midnight Chorus and sing This Little Light of Mine, you can call, we'll investigate on the air. I don't know whether this is. Are you going to do that? You're on the radio.
I would like to participate.
You could. Very
excellent.
Good.
That's great.
Okay, I am going to put you on hold. Okay.
Oh.
And I'll see if I can get some other people to join there. Okay. Okay. I hope you're still there. If you would like to participate in this sing-along of this little light, did we lose that? Wait a minute. Did we lose that call?
No, he's there.
Are you sure? Let's see if this is another person who wants to play this game. No, they've decided against it.
Well, we've scared them off.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Huh, you're on the radio. No, that's not the tune. That's not the tune. If you'd like to call 212-209-295.
No.
That's the number to pay for this nonsense. Right. 212-209-2900. That's the number to call. Okay, let's see if this...
let's get a chorus here.
How are you? Are you... Oh, too bad. That was Tiny Tim calling from the afterlife. You're on the radio. Hello?
Good morning.
Good morning. Will you sing along?
Yes, I will.
Thank you. Oh, well, you know what you do if you don't know the words. Make up some new ones.
Okay.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to put you on hold, and there may be one or two others that join us while you maybe do another song.
Okay, do a different song, and then we'll come back to this.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Actually, since we're on this theme of Pete, maybe I should do the song we wrote together. The has a wonderful story connected to it. Do we have time for a little bit of a story, you think, or... I know we have a clock there.
Sure, go ahead.
There were some women in Sayreville, New Jersey, who really wanted to do something for peace, but they had young children in the school system, so they couldn't really get out very much. And they came up with this idea that why not have the children in their schools give toys to children in Iraq? And maybe it would help create peacemakers of the future. The kids would get it. And also, they thought, well, a lot of the soldiers are really recruited out of the schoolyards. When they meet up with the families of
That's
these kids
right.
and so forth,
That's right.
new connections will be made.
In some places in the country, recruiters have gone to public school graduations.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And so it actually worked. And some of these soldiers had come back later and spoke against the war and for peace. And others just created a whole new atmosphere. Mm. Instead of being angry and afraid and thinking of these people as non-people, it suddenly was people that they connected with and could see as real people.
Well, there's a song in this.
There was. And
Let's
so
hear
when
it.
I when I told Pete about this, he said, we got to write the song. And so we started writing it. And here it is. Okay, we're getting technical here.
It's okay. We can zoom right in.
All right. We just had to do a little bit of technical stuff. If we only had a video cam, you would love this. But now we're set. Take the turnpike through New Jersey, where it meets the Garden State. If you take exit 11 there, instead of going straight, you can visit Sayreville, where Diana, mother of two, saw what war can do to kids, did what she had to do, because we have got to learn to live in peace someday. Maybe soldiers with toys, not guns, will find a better way. She said school children in Sayreville should give a toy or two to the children in Iraq, because they have so very few. Diane's neighbor Karen agreed, and soon a movement grew. Would the schools go along? What else could the school board do? Because we have got to learn to live in peace someday. Maybe soldiers with toys, not guns, will find a better way. So they set up big containers in the schools in Sayreville. It really was inspiring how quickly they would fill. Sarah brought her favorite doll, she told her not to cry. Soon she'd have a new best friend, she kissed that doll goodbye. Because we have got to learn to live in peace someday. Maybe soldiers with toys, not guns, will find a better way. The colonel said, let's do it, yes, we will try your plan. Our soldiers can give out toys in Iraq and Afghanistan. Those soldiers love to meet the kids, they hope their visits increase. When you make a child smile, you build a bridge to peace. Because we have got to learn to live in peace someday. Maybe soldiers with toys, not guns, will find a better way. Take the turnpike through New Jersey, where it meets the Garden State. If you take exit 11 there, instead of going straight, you can visit Sayreville, where Diana, mother of two, saw what war can do to kids and did what she had to do.
Well, it's those little things that capture people's imagination that really make the changes in
and it was it was a joint effort. Pete wrote half of it, I wrote half of it. We worked together on it for a long time until we said, this is it. This tells the story right. Mm-hmm. The women have an organization called Bridges of Peace. Mm-hmm. And if you look that up on Google, you can find out more about it. Also, if you want to hear some of these songs, we have a lot of videos up for free and emergency music about political issues up for free on our website, which is after the three W's, is raycorona.com. RayKorona.
All right. Hello? So, I think you're both on.
All right.
Are you on there, too?
Yes.
Okay. So that's two of you. If anybody else want to call and join along in the sing-along? Maybe some other people will join in as we proceed.
And if people sing really loud wherever they are, we might be able to hear them from through the window.
May I make a suggestion?
What's that?
And that is, if the other person can or cannot go with it, I would like to do after the first verse of This Little Light of Mine, you know, the usual chorus, then do two others, this littles, including this little dog of mine, and the other is this little station of mine.
Well, I like that idea, this little station of mine.
Okay.
How about we say WBAI? We're gonna let it shine.
Somehow, yeah. Okay. So yes to the station and no to the dog. Okay. All right, let's get see if there's
enough.
Hold on.
Okay.
Hi, you're on the radio.
Hey, yo.
Oh, you're out of it. Okay. Anyone who is not out of it who wants to join this chorus, just give us a call. We might let that guy in, you know, do part of the song just as a kind of a sop to his obsession, which I must say I respect. Absolutely. Anyway, let's
get it going.
Let's get it going.
So are these guys in the station going to sing along, I hope?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Here we go. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Let it shine. All around the world, I'm gonna let it shine. All around the world, I'm gonna let it shine. All around the world, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Ready for the station? This little station of mine.
I'm gonna let it shine.
This little station of mine.
I'm gonna let it shine.
This little station of mine.
Let it shine.
That's WBAI. We're gonna let it shine. Hey, WBAI. We're gonna let it shine.
WBAI. We're gonna let it shine.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody that was singing. It was wonderful. I have to tell Pete that y'all did it. He always says, did you get him to sing along?
Oh, that reminds me. The song of that title, This Little Light, that was actually a WBAI award-winning documentary that was done way back, remember?
That's
about
right.
The Civil Rights Movement.
That's right.
And the title, I think Dale Minor, one of the producers.
That's right.
This
That's
Little
right.
Light.
About voter registration in the South in 1963,
yeah,
64,
I think so.
Wow. 65, wow. Yeah.
That's when I first heard the title.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. If you want to stick around, I want to talk a little bit about Paul Krasner, whose new book it's very hard to read this book of Paul's because my glasses keep falling off my face with laughter, and sometimes they fog up with the tears of laughter. And at the same time, I feel, you know, so thrilled at the listen to this. This is not, I don't know whether Paul wants me to read from the book, but he's not here to stop me. So the book is called Who's to Say What's Obscene? And George Carlin said about Paul Krasner, the FBI was right. This man is dangerous. And funny and necessary. Art Spiegelman said, Krasner is one of the best minds of his generation to be destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, but mainly hysterical. Harry Shearer said, Paul taught me that extreme stylistic accuracy could make even the most bizarre comedic concept credible. He is a unique character on the American landscape, a self-described investigative satirist. He straddles the line between politics, culture, pornography, and drugs. In other words, the land where all of us, were we really honest with ourselves, would choose to dwell. Tom Robbins said, thanks to Paul Krasner for continuing to be the lobster claw in the tuna casserole of modern America. The San Francisco Chronicle said Krasner is absolutely compelling. He's lived on the edge so long that he gets his mail delivered there. And the New York Times, remember them? Said he's an expert at ferreting out hypocrisy and absurdism from the more solemn crannies of American culture. Kurt Vonnegut. I told Krasner one time that his writings made me hopeful. He found this an odd compliment to offer a satirist. I explained that he made supposedly serious matters seem ridiculous, and that this inspired many of his readers to decide for ourselves what was ridiculous and what was not, knowing that there were people doing that better late than never made me optimistic. And I'm just going to begin by reading very, 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 let's see. Oh, by the way, Jim Ferrat was supposed to be on the Colbert Report tonight. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah.
I don't get cable anymore.
Well, I don't even get television anymore. You know, I couldn't get that DTV thing to work. Wait a minute. I'm going to skip through the Arianna Huffington introduction just to find... Wait a minute. Be patient now.
While he's looking, I'm already convinced I'm going to get this book as soon as I can.
All right. Wait a minute now. Yeah. Hold on just a second. Who is to say what is obscene? 7 years after 9/11, Ari Fleischer warned Americans that they need to watch what they say and watch what they do. 7 years after Graydon Carter declared the death of the age of irony, 7 years after Politically Incorrect was pushed off the air, and 279 years after Jonathan Swift made his modest proposal that Irish children be sold as food, we seem to be living in a golden age of political humor, and especially political satire. Jon Stewart, Bill Maher, Stephen Colbert, viral YouTube videos, and after 33 years on the air, the rebirth of Saturday Night Live, which went from, is that still on, to must-see TV, or at least must-see on YouTube. They're all standing on the shoulders of the great comedic bomb throwers of the past. Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, George Carlin, the Smothers Brothers, the gang at the National Lampoon. Now that's the foreword by Arianna Huffington. She's putting him in that august body. Who's to say what's obscene? I'm not talking about profanity or pornography here. Take, for example, the fact that in arguments before a federal court, the Obama administration backed immunity for a notorious figure from the Bush administration, John Yoo, the author of legal memos used to justify torture and indefinite detention without trial as part of the war on terror. Now that's bleeping obscene. I'm saddened and outraged by the lack of accountability in government agencies, multinational corporations, and organized religions. Nobody wants to take the responsibility for the injustice and the anguish they cause. Dehumanization is the name of the game, and the players reek with arrogance. The creator of a new Coney Island sideshow attraction, the Waterboard Thrill Ride, asked a rhetorical question. What's more obscene? The official position that waterboarding is not torture, or our official position that it's a thrill ride? Tom Hayden wrote in an op-ed piece, with the Congress including $50 million for the arts in the economic package, the overall annual budget from the NEA will be just short of $200 million for the coming year. By comparison, we spend more on the Iraq War every day, or $341.4 million, according to the website costofwar.com. This is the real obscenity that goes uncensored. Yet, funding for the arts is more controversial than funding for war. For decades, arts subsidies have been targeted as frivolous waste by many of the same conservative Republicans willing to budget trillions for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. In a letter to the editor of the Los Angeles Times, Ken Johnson stated, it's fine to demand that U.S. automakers seeking federal money meet higher mileage requirements. But what about the workers who would pay for this increase in efficiency with their jobs? It's obscene that these corporate incompetents are begging for more of our tax dollars while at the same time contemplating more layoffs. It's even more obscene that our tough-talking lawmakers in Washington have said nothing about insisting that taxpayer money be used first to preserve these jobs. To give these automakers untold millions of dollars while allowing them to place thousands of skilled people on the public dole is just plain sinful. A syndicated editorial cartoon by Jeff Parker depicted a job seeker at the unemployment office explaining to the jaded clerk, I'm looking for a high-powered executive position where I can wreck the company and still get an obscene bailout-funded bonus, you know, like those guys at AIG. It's obscene that a secret state police report describes supporters of presidential candidates Ron Paul, Chuck Baldwin, and Bob Barr as militia-influenced terrorists and instructs the Missouri police to be on the lookout for the display of bumper stickers and other paraphernalia associated with the Constitutional Campaign for Liberty and libertarian parties. This isn't creeping fascism. It's galloping fascism. It's obscene that former Vice President Dick Cheney's office deleted nearly half of congressional testimony about the consequences of climate change on public health. The vast profits of our current energy, healthcare, insurance, pharmaceutical, and credit lending industries, all utterly obscene. Now, it goes on to tell you more about what is and what is not obscene, but I want to read another little section. This is about the death of Allen Ginsberg. Kent Kesey says, I was at a party one time when I first knew Allen Ginsberg, and he was standing by himself over by the fireplace with a wine glass in his hand and people milling around. And finally, some young girl sort of broke off from the rest of the crowd. And it's okay for Kesey to say young girl because, you know, it was on the road and it was 1950s, so, but no, if he were alive today, I'm sure he would use the proper appellation. Finally, some young girl broke off from the rest of the crowd and approached him and said, I can't talk to you. You're a legend. And he said, this is Allen Ginsberg. Yes, but I'm a friendly legend. The Ferlinghetti said, he lived so many flames. Today, the youth, like the 20-year-olds, are really turned on to Ginsberg and the Beat Poets. But the thing they're turned on to is the apolitical part. One forgets how political the Beats were in the 50s, which was Eisenhower and the McCarthy era, and that's a flame that seems to be flickering these days. Kesey said of Ginsberg again, he was a great warrior. I think that's more important than his poetry. In fact, in later terms, I haven't read much of his poetry at all because the warrior aspect of Ginsberg has loomed much larger. When we went to the Vietnam Day Parade up in Berkeley, they had been interviewing the Hells Angels. All the Hells Angels were going to come out and oppose the people opposed to the war. They were going to come out and start a riot, is what it was. So Ginsberg asked me to take him up there to where the angels hung out in this big white house in Oakland, and we went in there, and there's all these big brutes holding their beer cans with their beer bellies and their beards, and Ginsberg, he goes right in and he starts talking to them. And you look around, and there are these great, big, mean-looking guys wearing swastikas. Pretty soon, Ginsberg had just charmed the hell out of him, and there's not going to be a riot. He took himself into that. They marveled at him. It was the courage again, the courage of this man to come into this situation and defuse it. I would really like to go on after that because he talks about Chicago. Maybe I or Paul will read it later, but I really don't want to skip over this part. This is called The Power of Laughter. I spent a weekend in September 2007 at the 11th Annual Earth Dance Celebration, a global festival for peace held in Northern California, uniting with over 250 locations in 50 countries, providing a wide variety of live music, workshops, speakers, inspiration, and a worldwide sense of community. On Saturday, I was among a large group of men and women participating in the International Elders Forum, and each one had 6 minutes to share their wisdom with an overflowing crowd in the huge Electronica Dome. A Native American, David Rain of the Blackfoot tribe, would play the flute after 5 minutes of talk as a signal that there was 1 minute left. When my turn came, I began, whatever wisdom I have to share is in the form of comic relief, but just remember, if you don't laugh, you're only helping the terrorists. And after 7 minutes, I still didn't hear any notes from the flute, so I decided to pass the microphone on to the next person. On Sunday afternoon, David told me that he'd been laughing so hard he simply couldn't play his flute. He tried again and again, and the best thing that he could do was spit into it. Of course, this was gratifying feedback to a stand-up satirist. But over lunch, a conversation became deadly serious. In November 2006, he had wanted to sell a piece of equipment, and a man who saw the ad invited to him to his converted garage apartment. There, David was told to help himself to a soda from the refrigerator, which he did. When he turned around, 4 men, biker, skinhead, Aryan Nation types, burst through the door and attacked him with 2.5-inch metal pipes, first striking him on the forehead, then beating and kicking him while calling him a dog and a prairie nigger. He tried unsuccessfully to defend himself and finally dove out the first floor window, bouncing off a table and a car before landing on the ground. He pounded on somebody's door, yelling 911, then collapsed in a puddle of blood. He regained consciousness in a hospital where he got 40 stitches for a cracked cranium and a head brace for his broken neck. His shoulder and hand were also injured. He was rescued by a friend and stayed at her home to heal. He could no longer do physical work, but she helped him to open a small business. 2 weeks after the incident, on Thanksgiving Eve, police arrested David for missing a court date on a traffic violation. He had missed the date because he was unconscious in the hospital at the time. In the Sonoma County Jail, guards kicked him, removed his head brace, refused him all medical attention, placed him in solitary confinement, forced him to sleep on a concrete bed without a mattress, and did not allow him to shower for 6 days. They eventually brought him to court, chained to a wheelchair. After he was released on probation, the district attorney demanded that David testify against the skinheads. Knowing the nature of the Aryan gang, he immediately expressed concerns about his safety, regardless of what his testimony might be. A couple of months later, the DA agreed to place him in a witness protection program. Turned out to be at the Pink Flamingo, a hotel in Santa Rosa, the same city where he was attacked. On the third day, he walked out of the hotel and saw a crowd of bikers and skinheads hanging around. Not knowing that they were there for a tattoo convention, he panicked, returned to his non-smoking room, and smoked a cigarette. The alarm went off. For that offense, he was evicted from the hotel and taken out of the witness protection program. The DA was angry. She made it clear to him that we have ways of making you testify. The day before the trial, David was arrested again on the way to the Indian Health Center for driving with a suspended license. Again, he was denied medical attention. His head brace was removed, and he was thrown into solitary confinement. A week later, he was again brought into court, chained to a wheelchair, unbathed, looking like a wild Indian, he says, and threatened with 3 years in jail. The DA was in the courtroom at his sentencing, powwowing directly with the judge. Immediately before the sentencing, David's friend stood up and asked the court to speak out on his behalf, since his court-appointed lawyer had done so little to defend him. With a bailiff bearing down on her and contempt of court looming, the judge surprisingly agreed to let her talk. She stated how jailing David was cruel and unusual punishment because he would have to be placed in solitary confinement throughout his incarceration in order to avoid any contact with Aryan gang members due to his status as a hate crime victim. He was in violation of driving with a suspended license only because he couldn't afford to pay the fines. His injuries prevented him from being able to work in his chosen field to earn money to pay those fines. Was driving with a suspended license actually worth 3 years of anyone's life? Or was there another agenda lurking in the courtroom that needed such leverage to pressure David into testifying against the assailants? Was it justice to, in effect, condemn him for the heinous crime of poverty? The judge weighed the case, and the next day released David on probation, warning him not to drive. Almost a year later, the DA was still hounding him by phone and subpoena, putting his life in danger by coercing him to testify. And where was victim's assistance during all of this horror? A victim witness advocate told David, "I can't help you. You're on probation. Our hands are tied." Since David was a victim, he didn't have the right to a public defender. He was due to appear in court the week after Thanksgiving 2007. And as I write this, he plans to say that he will not testify because if concern for my safety is not addressed, I could die. He expects to be charged with contempt and once again to be put in solitary confinement. In the hope of extricating him from this profane injustice of criminalizing a victim, I was able to find a couple of attorneys who could give him helpful advice, and ultimately, he didn't have to testify. Well, I'm grateful to be in a position to communicate the details of this nightmare, none of which I would have known had David been able to play his flute after 5 minutes of laughter. That's called The Power of Laughter. And then that's Paul Krasner. And he was my very first guest in, I think, 1963 on Radio Nemo. And I have absolute agreement with someone who said somewhere about Paul, he's one of those people who's life can change other people's consciousnesses permanently. He certainly did that for me. And I think we should call him up in a little while. Maybe after we play another one of these. Let's see here.
We're Mahina Movement,
shouting out to
all of you to join us for a benefit concert for WBAI.
On Friday, July 17th, 7 p.m., featuring Judy Gorman, the Ray Corona Band,
Mahina Movement,
and the New York City Raging Grannies and their daughters.
We'll see you at Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church, 85 South Oxford Street, Brooklyn, USA.
Help save our most progressive radio station.
To be free.
I am the daughter of a bastard race.
Is that you? Are you on the radio?
That's me. With me. I'm on the radio.
Hi, that was your theme when you did a radio show, wasn't it?
I couldn't hear it. What was it?
She comes in colors.
Oh, yeah, the Stones. Yeah, no, I like that. It was very psychedelic, actually. Psychedelic sexualis.
Well, as I was leafing through your book just now, I saw Mountain Girls, the section where Mountain Girl meets with Albert Hoffman.
Yes, there are people who don't know. Mountain Girl is alias Carolyn Garcia. She's Jerry Garcia's widow, one of them, and she was also a card-carrying member of Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters.
Ah. Well, you and I went to levitate the Pentagon with the woman you were with, the woman who was on the cover of
One of Richard Brautigan's books?
Right, one of Richard Brautigan's books. You told me her name was Mountain Girl.
No, it wasn't. No, it was.
What is her name?
It's been so many years, I forget.
Well, we have to try to find that out. But can I read, or would you like to read the section where she, between her and Albert Hoffman?
Let me find that whole.
That's on page 160. Page Mountain 60. Girl remembers Albert Hoffman.
Okay, let me see. Okay, page 160.
It's a wonderful book, Paul. I really, it's thrilling. You know, it's too good. You know, it's like just as. David had trouble blowing the flute. I had trouble reading it because my glasses kept falling off with laughter.
Oh, well, that's great. I mean, I don't. Did you read on the air that David flute?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay, so they know the reference.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that was a strange moment, but I try to capture it. Okay, page 160. Do you want me to read that whole piece or just part of it?
Well, read it until I say, "Oh, Paul, I'm getting bored."
All right, that's fine.
Okay.
It's called Mountain Girl Remembers Albert Hoffman. On the day that the man who discovered LSD, Dr. Albert Hoffman, died at the age of 102, the Onions ostensibly asked people what they thought. Quote, "It's just like I tell my kids," replied one. "If you get involved with drugs, you're going to end up dead." The death of this renowned Swiss chemist also inspired David Letterman to share with his audience that same evening the fact that researchers have combined LSD with birth control pills so you can take a trip without the kids. The New York Times obituary stated that in April 1943, Hoffman, quote, "accidentally ingested the substance that became known to the 1960s counterculture as acid," unquote. But the Los Angeles Times obituary stated that he had, quote, "accidentally gotten the trace amount of an experimental compound called lysergic acid diethylamide on his fingertips and taken the world's first acid trip."
Oh, I haven't taken acid, Paul, but I forgot to do a station break.
Oh.
This is WBAI in New York City. We're also being heard on KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. And in 20 minutes, we'll be joined by WJFF in Grahamsville, Liberty, and Jeffersonville. New York, and we're being heard on the World Wide Web, possibly around the world. So, Paul Krasner, proceed.
Okay. Well, in the good old days, you would have done that station break by saying, "And speaking of hallucinations, this is WBAI."
Thank you, Paul.
You're welcome, Bob.
But that was an homage to. Gene Shepard, who used to do that.
Oh, that's true. That's true. And also the guy who invented the Segway. All right. Anyway, the
wait a minute. That thing you ride on?
Yes, yes. I couldn't remember his name. I think it's Pat Pending. okay. So here's the accurate answer to that. In Hoffman's own words, from his book LSD, My Problem Child, quote: "How have I managed to absorb this material? Because of the known toxicity of ergot substances, I always maintained meticulously neat work habits. Possibly a bit of the LSD solution had contacted my fingertips during crystallization, and a trace of the substance was absorbed through the skin," unquote. At first, he didn't know what caused his mysteriously scary and beautiful reactions. He tried breathing the solvents he had used with no effect. But then, he said in an interview on his 100th birthday, quote, "LSD spoke to me. He came to me and said, 'You must find me.' He told me, 'Don't give me to the pharmacologist. He won't find anything,'" unquote. That reminded me of what, by the way, when I interviewed Dr. Robert Spencer, who was a humane abortionist during the 60s when it was illegal, and ran a clinic in Ashland, Pennsylvania. And when I asked him about it, he said almost poetically, in performing an abortion, he said, "It talks to you. The womb talks to you." And he really made it seem like, a work of humane art rather than a murder, as the right-wing religionists call it. All right, I will continue. 4 weeks before his death, Carolyn Garcia had given a speech at the World Psychedelic Forum in Basel, where Hoffman lived, and she was invited to meet him.
Basil, maybe it's Basil.
Basil Rathbone, long live him. "He was so sweet to me," she recalls, "chatted and talked about and joked about musicians and black market LSD, chocolate and cherry trees, instructed me very seriously about the importance of hanging upside down every day to improve the blood flow to the brain. He discussed with an old friend, either Jury or Hurry, it begins with a J, I'll say Hurry Stick, whether Sandoz Laboratories would approach other chemical companies to make LSD for the new studies being conducted in Europe. Important studies on LSD and dying, cancer relief, and spiritual psychological benefits of its use for rebalancing people in crisis. Long overdue," they said. Carolyn asked Hoffman if the purification of LSD was a long process. He denied it and said, "LSD is very easy to make. You just do the recipe, and if it crystallizes, that is it. It's done and very pure. No need to do anything else." She told him a little about the Grateful Dead. Quote, "And he lit up and said he had always been hearing about them. They played existential music, yes, and from small beginnings it got large." And then he continued, "With the help of LSD, the energy and telepathic melting together as they played, he understood that." Carolyn Garcia saying that, that Hoffman understood that, the energy and telepathic melting together. He asked about Jerry, and Hoodie reminded him about the acid tests, and he lit up again and said, "Oh, yes, the acid tests, and the Grateful Dead played there long also. And you were there?" And she says, I smiled, yes, and pulled out the acid test diploma I had made for him. I presented it in the usual fashion, saying that he had proven beyond doubt that he had fulfilled all the requirements and had certainly passed the acid test and had earned this acid test diploma. When Carolyn left, he, quote, "smiled and asked me to come back and bring the sun, please. The wind was whipping the snow out of the trees as silent puffs of feathers. The walkway to the car was thick with ice. A few cat tracks showed the way. I didn't get to meet the cat who sleeps on the doctor's bed since his wife passed away. Now where's the cat sleeping tonight?" Unquote. The U.S. government banned LSD in October 1966, and other countries followed. Hoffman insisted that this was not fair. He argued that the he argued that the drug wasn't addictive and campaigned for the ban to be lifted so that LSD could be used in medical research. In December 2007, Swiss authorities decided to allow the drug to be used in the psychotherapy research project. For me, Hoffman told Swiss TV, this is a very big wish come true. I always wanted to see LSD get its proper place in medicine. On the day of his death, the Albert Hoffman Foundation declared that, quote, Dr. Hoffman's discoveries have touched countless people and brought tremendous change to the world in many in more ways than can be counted. We are very glad that Dr. Hoffman could still witness the early stages of new studies with LSD that will start in Switzerland in the near future. So so that's encouraging, you know. What it only took 40 years or so for and Switzerland to fill those holes in their cheese with acid.
And we should make it clear that there was no known connection, family, between Albert Hoffman and Abby Hoffman.
No, no, they're names are spelled differently, in fact. Just as during
Albert is not the same as Abby, but it's H-O-F-F, isn't it?
Two N's.
I think it's one F and two N's.
Oh.
I remember during the Chicago conspiracy trial, when I was testifying, and the judge kept, when I would talk about Mr. Hoffman, and he said, don't get him confused with Mr. Von Hoffman. Who was Nicholas von Hoffman, a reporter, I think, for the Washington Post then.
Or the Judge Hoffman.
Judge Hoffman. Well, he was confused by himself. He didn't need any help.
Well, you were pretty confused at the trial, too, weren't you?
Oh, I was tripping at the time, yeah.
Uh-huh. You want to talk about that?
Well, you know, I had brought a bunch of acid with me because I thought we would have a party, and I was insensitive thinking about that because these guys were on trial, and it was very serious, and so there was no party. So at lunchtime, before I was due to testify, they were passing around a chunk of hash between the defendants and the attorneys, and I said no because I didn't want to get dry mouth during my testimony. but I said, I'll do this instead, and I took out this little aspirin-like looking of 300 micrograms of Owsley white lightning acid. Is that product placement? And I said, I think I'll take this. And Abby said, I don't think you better. Is that acid? And Jerry Rubin said, do it. But at the time, he was just advertising his book. But I ignored both of them and took it. And you know, it really started hitting heavily as I was in the witness room waiting to come in. And Tom Hayden and Jerry Rubin brought me into, at when I was starting to peak, they brought me into, I perceived them as Tom and Jerry. And, they brought me into the courtroom. And so, it was a very strange trip. Abby Hoffman thought that I was being irresponsible and in a sense betraying him and the other defendants. And
wanted to do some theater at the trial.
Well, I was hoping. You know, I had known from experience that if you took a tab of acid, if you ingested that, and you had a big lunch, you were very likely to throw up. And so I thought that I would throw up in court.
And to express your feelings about the trial. That would be great. Wouldn't it have been better, though, maybe to take Ipecac?
What does that do?
Makes you throw up.
Oh. Well, but I also want to enhance the experience.
Oh. Right. Well, so what was your testimony like?
Well, it was a little bit scattered. Like, you know, they would say, where did this meeting take place? and I couldn't think of the word Chicago. And Abby was there, and he was like playing charades, you know, going, showing it was three syllables. And then the bailiff rushed, you know, to him and as if to say, no coaching from the audience. And so then the prosecutor said that my loss of memory was indicting me. And I said, that's not fair. I mean, I took it personally. And, you know, it really is a myth that you can necessarily get rid of your ego, by, you know, psychedelic drugs. It might help put it in perspective, but, it doesn't mean that, you lose that sense of connection of, with your, the core of yourself. So, anyway, Abby stopped speaking to me for 10 months. Now, when we had once we're going to see a movie called The Professionals with, it was Kirk Douglas and who played, and Burt Lancaster. And The Professionals referred to the fact that they were professional revolutionaries, and it was Abby's favorite movie. But we didn't get a chance to see it that time. But back in New York, there was a theater. I don't think it's there anymore, on Avenue D. Do you remember? The Charles Theater, I think it was. That may not be there anymore. But there was an ad in the paper that The Professionals was playing there. And so I just ripped it out of the paper, put it in an envelope, and sent it to Abby. And then he contacted you, Bob. You were the go-between, and you said that Abby wanted to reconcile, and that I want to have dinner with him and Anita. And so we did. You know, we had missed each other, but there was that certain pride, and I could understand how, you know, that he really thought that I had put him in danger. And but he had given me mixed signals because he told me the night before I testified that he wanted me to drive the judge crazy. So I thought I was doing the right thing in his eyes. But he said you were creamed, and I felt like Barack Obama when they said he said that he inhaled. He said that was the idea.
Well, you inhaled too. You were one of the first people to smoke in public with Allen Ginsberg.
Oh, I also smoked on some television show by Martin somebody. I forget his name. He was a kind of pompous guy, and I was talking about it.
Could it be Martin Abend?
Yeah, that's who it was.
Who was later busted for trying to evade a subway fare, by the way. That ended his career.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, huh. God works in mysterious ways.
Well, do you remember the sweep-in?
Of course I do, yeah.
And do you remember that after mid-morning, when the press was beginning to show up, the commissioner of sanitation, who had tried to stop our event by cleaning the street that we had selected beforehand,
right,
showed up in his chauffeured limousine and tried to get the attention of the press. You remember that?
Co-opt the thing, you mean?
Then the street was changed.
Do you know that he was the first person in the Lindsay administration to be indicted?
What was his name?
Oh, well, it's the...
something like Maroney, or...
Oh, wait, not... yeah, these are several decades ago, but...
Right, a long time ago.
but it's... I remember that specifically because I had rented the Village Theater, this was before it was Fillmore East, to do a show there. And I was so inspired by seeing these young people just cleaning the streets that I gave out tickets to those people who were doing that. And then since I had to pay for the box office too, they had to go to the box office and get the tickets torn in half. And I did the show, and it was such a great spirit there. I also, there were two panhandlers, you know, grizzled old guys wearing, ripped up old overcoats. And they asked, can I have one of those tickets too? So I gave them tickets, and they showed up. And then one of them started to heckle me during the show. And the other one answered. And I said something like, it's like, this, is this a production of Waiting for Godot? But it was good because it just had so much spontaneous spark and you know, an audience of stoned hippies who had done a good deed that morning, they just went with the flow and they weren't cynical like they would be, people would be today and say, oh, those are just hired actors to play those two old, grizzled old panhandlers. A strange time. I just can't imagine that being done now. People cleaning up the streets themselves to show the sanitation department what it should look like.
No, I think, you know, I mean, I think sanitation does an infinitely better job than they used to do in those years in Manhattan, although there are some areas where... you'd hardly know that they were there. But it was, our idea of theater. I think it actually was Emmett Grogan's idea. You want to talk a little bit about Emmett Grogan? Is there anything about him in the book? I haven't come across it.
I don't think so. Not in this book. I talk about him in my autobiography, which was published in 1993, but there's now a digital distribution company that wants to digitalize it. You know, being brought up to date and expanding it. But Emmett Grogan was a non-leader of, along with other non-leaders like Peter Coyote, that's his current name as an actor, and Peter Berg, and they were essentially the main non-leaders of the Diggers in San Francisco, which was sort of a... psychedelic social workers Emmett Grogan was a very colorful character. He was, you know, pure Irish, pure con man, pure hustler, pure idealist, pure junkie. Everything was pure, and he was a great con man. Artist and just pretending that he didn't want attention, but using his celebrity to get attention. And he and Abby started off as allies, but ended up
fierce enemies. Yeah.
With what?
Fierce enemies.
Yeah. Well, Grogan kept accusing Abby of stealing his ideas, even though. He had kept insisting that everything was free. So if something is free, how can you steal it? They even had the free store where shoplifting was encouraged.
He was a pretty good writer, too.
Grogan, well, you know, but he wasn't accurate. If you look at his book, Ringolivio, virtually everybody that he wrote about, from Abby and Jerry and me and Dave Dellinger and... anybody who wasn't one of his followers or part of his original gang, he put down, and he put them down viciously. So he was a good writer.
He liked me.
He didn't say anything negative about you?
No, he didn't. But you did.
I said something negative about you?
I'm sure you must have sometime or other.
No, I never say anything off the record.
You never say anything negative about anybody.
No, that's not true. But it's true. I've learned. I used to be self-righteous about stuff like that. But I've mellowed in the sense that it comes from Krishnamurti. You know, I change my concept of God every few years. And my current one is something that Krishnamurti said. He insisted he was not a guru. And he appeared in Carnegie Hall, and there were about 3,000 non-disciples there. And after he spoke, there was a question and answer period, and somebody said, "Why is there evil in the world?" And Krishnamurti said, "To thicken the plot." And I loved the implications of that because, you know, it started me seeing reality through the prism of theatrics. And I began to, instead of, you know, if there were jerks or if there were evil people, whatever, however I perceived them, I would just admire how well they played themselves. And it took away the negative aspect of things because, in fact, my wife Nancy was sitting at an event next to a science fiction writer, Octavia Butler, who gave such great simple advice on writing fiction that it can be applied to life, which was, she said, take one of the evil characters in the book and find some good things about that person. So it's interesting to do that. You know, I'm in correspondence with a guy in prison who killed his mother. And, you know, I don't lecture him about it. I don't even ask about it. It just happened. And
well, you also were in correspondence with Jay Washington, who was in prison for not killing somebody.
Exactly, yeah. Jerome Washington was the first black yippie. And Jimi Hendrix was the second. If you remember, on for Valentine's Day in 1969, the yippies sent out hordes of marijuana joints wrapped up in a fact sheet and mailed them to all kinds of groups, teachers, attorneys, media people.
Judges.
And judges, yeah, absolutely.
One individual
who they'd sent just because of his name in the phone book. It was Peter Pott. And they figured it was appropriate to send one to him. And one media guy, I forget his name.
Scarborough, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, I don't think, is it? No, it wasn't him. It was who showed one of the joints that he had gotten in the mail on his news program, and the police came while he was on the air, and I guess he invited them, and they told him that he was holding an illegal substance.
Right. Now he's sitting there in this pseudo cafe that they had where they did the news from. It looked more like a donut shop than a news desk. And he was sitting there, and in front of him there was a little placard that had his name on it, right? And the FBI, and he's like, you know, one of the most recognized faces in the world, right? And these two polices in raincoats come up and say, are you Chuck Jorgensen? Are you Harry Reid or whatever it was?
Oh, Jorgensen. It might have been him.
Yeah. And he said, well, yes. And they say, you have... He said, oh, yes, well, I was keeping it so you could have the evidence.
Jim Jensen?
Jim Jensen.
Jim Jensen, that's
right.
What it was.
Jim Jensen. Excellent. Right.
Excellent memory.
Well, no, it was Bill Propp's memory.
Yes, I know it was Bill.
Right. See, LSD helps an awful lot.
Right. We'll call you into the research lab tomorrow.
Well, let's see. What else was... I wanted you to recall the letter that went with that joint, if you remember it. Who wrote?
It just described.
Who wrote the letter?
I know Abby did some of the research because I think John Lindsay was the mayor then, and he was, and they were cracking down, and I'm not sure if that was the time. That might have been the, or was it Governor Rockefeller? Was that at the time when he went to, had pushed for the 15 years to life sentences?
That was September 73.
Oh, yeah, that was later.
That's
wow.
Great memory.
Gee.
What day?
Right.
What time, first. What time of day?
And how was the weather that day? And what teams were playing? And who won? And how many hit?
And what did you have for breakfast?
Yes. Just check out the jacket.
Right. Well,
around
do you
that
remember the letter?
No, I don't. I probably have it somewhere in my files.
Wow.
I'm going through my files. There are a few colleges that might be interested in my archives, which I translate as all the crap in my garage.
Well, there's
one person's crap and another person's treasure, Paul.
That's true. Well, it's, you know, history.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, this is a paraphrase. If I'm wrong, you can, you know, correct me. Yes, here it is. It's what you think it is. You may have heard of it. It's called marijuana. It's a simple drug. It's innocent until you smoke it. In which case, you've destroyed the evidence, and so you can't be arrested. There's no such thing as internal possession, this was then. But here's how you do it. You'll light it up and take a puff, not too deep, because you don't want to cough it out, but hold it for as long as you can, and then when you feel you can, take another one, and soon you'll begin to feel a wonderful, euphoric feeling that you'll remember for a long time. However, as wonderful and as harmless as it seems, it is not without harm. If you get caught with it, these are the penalties that you will have to pay. Sound like it's a little unfair? Well, it is. And it was signed with love, Yippee.
Well, you got the essence of it there, but there were some facts about, you know, statistics about arrests and but it was really a good and necessary piece of theater. And when you think about that now, you realize that currently there seems to be a tipping point in the media reflecting the population about the unfairness of the laws, and more states are passing legislation making medical marijuana legal, and it's the people who are against it who say, well, that's just a wedge for getting recreational marijuana use accepted. And Dennis Perone, who was one of the co-authors of Prop 215 in California, which was the first state to have medical marijuana referendum passed, he said all marijuana is medical. And in the sense that, and you know, it's true because it can make people feel.
And health is recreational.
Health is recreational. I've never heard that. tell that to the doctors.
Well, I feel good. I can have a, you know, I feel good.
But that's
the
point. So much. It can help. It can help ease stress. It can help put things in perspective. Yeah. And so much of disease is caused by stress. That it's not just a jokey remark by Dennis Perone. It seems to be factual.
Well, there's more to it than that. It's a vasodilator. It helps bring more blood to your brain. There's been some not completely proven.
Well, you have to remember to breathe.
Yes, you do, and breathing is good. It helps you to breathe. It opens your lungs. But no more commercials for that.
Maybe they'll deliver a carton.
You know, we are also now being broadcast on WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York. And we are following a young woman whose name is Liberty and who broadcasts primarily to the many people who are incarcerated in Sullivan County, where this radio station WJFF can be heard. So welcome to our WJFF listeners. And if you or anyone in Alaska or anywhere on the World Wide Web, including New York City, wants to talk to Paul Krasner, we might be taking some telephone calls in a little while. Is that all right, Paul?
Of course. No, Liberty, which is upstate New York, was one of the two places where I was subpoenaed by a district attorney, and I guess about 1970, when I was an abortion underground abortion referral service, when it was still illegal, and when Dr. Spencer died, I continued my practice. No, he retired. He was forced to retire.
You have to say who Dr. Spencer was.
Oh, Dr. Robert Spencer, who was a ran a clinic for abortions for people, women from all over the country.
It was
in Ashland, Pennsylvania.
Right. And he was...
And he charged as little as $5.
Right. And everyone in town seemed to know about it. And seemed to approve of it.
Well, yeah, because they not only tolerated him, they depended on him because he brought so much business, you know, to the dress store, to the restaurant, to the motel, to the bus company, and whatever other shopping people would do. And also he helped people in that city, including some of the police and some of the priests. So it was like a play by that. There's a playwright who wrote stuff like that. Maybe it was Harold Pinter. He was a great, he was a jolly guy, like the guy who plays Santa Claus, I think, in Miracle on 34th Street, Edmund Gwenn.
Right.
And he was, you know, he had rosy cheeks, and he wore a beret, and he had on the ceiling above the operating table little... little folksy sayings, and there was they wouldn't allow African Americans, or as they were called in those days, Negroes, to stay in the local motel because of discrimination. And Dr. Spencer built a room at his clinic where they could stay overnight. And When he retired, he recommended a couple of other physicians who were performing that surgery, and I guess as a procedure, I'm not sure what the difference is. And I got called before two district attorneys. One was in New York, the Bronx DA. Then was Burton Roberts, who is now a judge, And there was a DA in Liberty, New York, and he had me come to. They sent a driver to drive me from my loft on Avenue A to up to Liberty, New York. He came about 6 o'clock in the morning, and so the DA there said, you know, we know all about this. The Dr. So and so confessed everything, and I said, oh, I better call my lawyer. He said, yeah, you better, because the cops are going to come here, and they're going to be here at 2 o'clock. And so, you know, you better make up your mind whether you're going to testify before the grand jury or not, because if not, the cops are going to bust you. So I went outside to a phone booth and called not a lawyer. I didn't have a lawyer at the time, but I called the doctor. And I told them what they told me, that they taped this conversation they had with him where he confessed everything. He said, none of that is true. They're bluffing. So I said, okay, thanks. And I went back there, and he said, so what'd your lawyer say? And I said, oh, my lawyer said I should continue to not cooperate with you.
Uh-huh.
And so they said, okay, the cops are going to get here. And 2 o'clock came, and they said, okay, you can go home now. Just like that. It's a common tactic that district attorneys use. The one in New York was, he said, we got the cops, we got the doctor's financial records, and we know the money that they have given you. And so I knew he was bluffing because I would never take a penny from any doctor. And a couple who had offered me a kickback, I refused and insisted that they take however much of a kickback they were going to give me, that they take that off what they charge the women. So I knew he was bluffing. If I had ever taken anything, I wouldn't have known he was bluffing. And so he stuck out his hand like to shake hands with me, as if, okay, well, now that you know we got stuff on you, you know, we're going to agree that you'll testify. And I refused to shake hands with him. I said that's not true. And but that's the tactics they use. You know that it's like a poker game to them, bluffing, and to people who are innocent, it's they're dealing with people who want to advance their own careers and don't really care about whether you're going to spend time behind bars or not. In fact, they want you to because it's good for their career. What was the question?
You're on the radio.
Attention spotter.
Hello.
You're on the radio with Paul Krasner.
Aaron. Hello. Yes. Hey, Paul.
Hello, hello.
It's Aaron Kay, the Yippie Pie Man.
Well, another Santa Cruz took place today. Anybody here ever heard of a name Sky Saxon?
No.
Ever heard of a band called The Seeds?
No, but you're breaking up. You're very loud, Aaron.
Okay. Well, let me take a chance to turn my radio down. Let me hobble over there. Well, give me a second. Start to limp over there. My game. Give me a
second. What, does he have his radio on? Is that it?
I think his radio is in the next apartment.
Oh.
is this much better now?
Yes, much better.
Okay. Well, I know we lost Michael Jackson and Farrah Fawcett. Well, there was a band. Remember that song, Pushing Too Hard, that came out around 67?
I'll take your word for it.
Well, there's a band that came out of L.A. called The Seeds.
Yeah.
They're a psychedelic band.
Remember them.
Well, the lead singer passed away today, too, in Austin, Texas. He was about 65, 70 years old. Yeah, check it out, everybody. Sky Saxon.
Yeah.
Well, if I had one of his bits of music, I would play that, too. Do you want to comment on Michael Jackson's death, Paul?
Well, it's interesting just how much of the news has taken up. It looked like Keith Olbermann on MSNBC took up the whole hour on it and continued into Rachel Maddow's hour. But it was the lead story on all three network news shows. And and I predicted one by one the order they would come in, that Michael Jackson would come first because he, you know, he's known worldwide, then Farrah Fawcett, then the governor of South Carolina, and maybe then 80 people died from a drone that dropped bombs on Pakistan. So the reason is because people and they showed at UCLA Medical Hospital, there were crowds outside there who just wanted to be there. And on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, a lot of people were leaving flowers on the, you know, they have the stars, the Avenue of the Stars, and they had flowers put on the star of Michael Jackson. except that it was not Michael Jackson, the singer's star. It was the star of Michael Jackson, the radio talk show host. So, but it's the thought that counts.
Well, Michael Jackson made so much money for the recording industry, and somehow he managed to get a fair amount of it for himself for a time, and then was taken away by lawsuits.
You know, I was trying to think if I had ever done any Michael Jackson jokes. Because they were so obvious, and they were so also always, and they were based on stereotypes. The only thing I could remember was I published an article in The Realist by Kevin Bright, who was the producer of Friends, and he was a friend, and that was before Facebook Friends, when you had friends that you actually knew, and he wrote a piece about, you know, Michael Jackson was a Jehovah's Witness. And Jehovah's Witnesses are supposed to, you know, go in pairs to people's houses and knock on doors so they can get brownie points in heaven above. And so he just wrote a funny piece about Michael Jackson going to people's doors, and they wouldn't believe it was him. And but, you know, he had the two T's that often go together, talent and tragedy. You know, his childhood was taken away from him, and it scarred him for life because it was all he knew. You know, was that he was a child performer, and
he was
a phenomenal
dancer.
Oh yeah, that was
incredible.
The talented
dancer.
Part.
The and talented it, part, and his Thriller. Was maybe created music videos.
That's a good point.
It looked like the Night of the Living Dead is directed by Busby Berkeley.
Yeah, good comparison. And you know, now the vultures are going to pour in, you know, over the money stuff, and it's going to be interesting to see who gets custody of the children. And the Jackson family, they're not related in any way, because it was not Michael Jackson's semen that was used to impregnate this, I forget her name, it had a D in it, Deborah something.
The nurse.
Yeah, and but she at some point, for money, signed away her rights. Of her parental rights, so I doubt very much that she would get the children. It's hard. Probably the nannies will. They probably know the kids best. But anyway, it's interesting to see how some of the people on the news took it so gravely, you know, and talked to people who were so shocked, but. You know, there's a logic to it, you know, between being overworked at the age of almost 51 and taking so many prescription drugs and, you know, having such trauma in his life, there's a logic to him dying young. Not a fairness, but... almost a certain inevitability, and he's almost like a Shakespearean character, you know, in terms of erasing the line between creativity and self-destructiveness.
Couldn't that be said of Lenny Bruce too, for that matter?
I don't think so, because I don't think that he was accused of being self-destructive for continuing to perform without compromising, and I would say that he was uncompromising rather than that's self-destructive.
Yeah, Michael Jackson wasn't attacked for his talent ever. Lenny Bruce was attacked for his talent.
Exactly, yeah.
Good distinction.
Yeah.
And there are those who say he was self-destructive because of the drugs he used, but, you know, it was on the cusp of an accidental OD and suicide, but the suicide, there were reasons. He had just lost, he was going to, his home for not paying the mortgage because he couldn't get work. And so he had so much pressure on him, you could think about it. On the other hand, when he died, you know, the kettle of water was still boiling on the stove. His electric typewriter, you remember them, was still humming away. He had stopped in the middle of a word, and it was something about, I think it was in the middle of the word Constitution.
This was Lenny Bruce, not Michael Jackson.
Yes, correct. But, you know, everybody has some little touch of self-destructiveness. I mean, even Barack Obama smoked cigarettes. There was an editorial cartoon which showed him standing behind a building, smoking a cigarette, looking guilty. And just around the corner was a little kid smoking a cigarette and looking guilty. And but it's interesting because I just started doing some research. You know, the tobacco is still subsidized by the government, by the same government that's trying to get people to stop smoking. I mean, it's really a schizophrenic process.
Well, you said accidental overdose before, Paul. I thought of Abbie Hoffman, for that matter, also. Another person on the cusp of a lot of contributory factors.
And he did commit suicide. I mean, there was no doubt about that. There were some conspiracy theorists who said, no, he was assassinated and made to look like a suicide. But
couldn't he have lost track of what he took? Couldn't he have lost track of how many or how much he took?
What he took was exactly what he said that Bob, what was the name of that guy, Bud, something who during the Watergate hearings tried to commit suicide. And you know who I mean.
Right.
M. It began with an M, his last name. But anyway, and Abby used to
Magruder.
Joke about that.
Huh? Was it Magruder?
No, not him, no. But anyway, he was unsuccessful, and Abby said, here's what he should have taken. And that's what Abby took. And, you know, he had attempted suicide before and failed. And he was clinically manic depressive. So so his was a deliberate overdose stuff. And it was not, you know, at the also, it was the first time since he was 15 that he was not living with a girl or a woman or had a mate. And at that point he was separated from
Johanna.
Mm-hmm. And living, I think, in a chicken coop or something in New Jersey. But he was unhappy, and in some ways he felt the parade was passing by, and he was disappointed in the younger generation. I mean, there were all these things.
He said, don't trust anybody under 30.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And also he was in physical pain because he had been in this accident where he broke his foot or something. And it's hard to say what's self-destructive or not. He might have, in order to survive, he was selling cocaine. But you know, if you're a celebrity of sorts, people will boast, "Hey, you know who I got this coke from?" And so, in a sense, that was being self-destructive. But it was hard for somebody like Abby to when so much stress when he was when underground. At the same time that I went nuts from information overload when I was just researching and investigating questions that were raised by Ed Sanders in his book on the Manson family.
We may get a call from Ed Sanders this morning.
You got one already?
We may.
Oh, oh.
Because he's, you know, Thule has had some problems.
I heard about that.
Stroke,
yeah.
And he's home now, and he's, I wouldn't say he's recovered, but he's recovering some of the vision that he lost with the stroke. He's now beginning to see colors, like in that song.
Oh, that's good. It's sad when a visionary loses his vision.
Yes, it is.
And that's what he was. I remember meeting him first. It must have been in the 50s.
We're talking about Thule Kupferberg.
Thule Kupferberg, who was one of the original Fugs. He was an anarchist. He's, how old is he now?
About 85, I think.
Uh-huh.
Close to.
And I saw him, and he was ahead of his time. He was, I would see him on Sheridan Square, on his bicycle, handing out leaflets as he rode by people. He was just, he was a true anarchist in the best sense of the word, and a nonviolent anarchist, although one time he got really, really, really angry about something and spewed these, not hateful phrases, but, you know, just such disdain. And I said, I thought you were a pacifist. And he said, yeah, but you have to let it out somehow.
Well, shall we maybe do some more from the book, or do you want to, you know, take a bathroom break, or maybe a station break is in order? It's WBAI, listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City that you're listening to now, with our signal being carried over KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska. And CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. That's in Canada. And WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, the place that Paul was talking about a little while ago. And we're also being heard streaming on the World Wide Web at WBAI.org. So if you know of anybody who might want to hear Paul, who's listening, who could be listening in another part of the country, why don't you give them a call and tell them to tune to WBAI.org and maybe call us here at WBAI at 212-209-2900. And you're on the radio.
Oh, thank you. I'm over the radio.
Hello.
Okay, Paul?
Yes.
Bob?
Yes, hi. Turn your radio down, please.
What?
Turn your radio down.
It's off.
Okay, good.
Okay, I don't know about the scene, but I know the difference between what's erotic and what's pornographic.
Huh?
He wants to, you to tell him the difference between what's erotic and what's pornographic.
Oh, that's funny. You know, I just interviewed. Let me just boot this up because I asked her that exact question.
Who?
And I want to get her exact words. It was a simple answer, but I just want to.
Who?
Is it Gloria Leonard? Because I told her.
Huh?
It was Gloria Leonard. I told her.
You told.
You know
Susie
the difference is? Bad lighting.
Oh, bad lighting. Oh, that's funny.
That's the only difference.
But I'll tell you what her answer was. I'm just booting it up right now. Okay, here it is. I said, what distinction would you make between erotica and porn? And her answer was three words, marketing and politics. So, because they both have the same purpose, which is to arouse the reader.
Prurient interest.
Yes, yes.
And you're on the radio.
Yeah, Bob, did you see today's Villager?
No, I didn't.
Well, we AJ Weberman, what WBAI needs is an electrician to wire Bob Fest's control panel in a manner that each time he senses me, he gets a progressively stronger electric shock. AJ Weberman.
He wants me to stop censoring him.
Yeah.
Well, I only censor out what he says that's either insane or...
libelous.
Or libelous.
Well, I agree with
or
you.
Or stupidest.
I agree with you. I just thought I'd bring that to your attention.
Sometimes all three can be combined.
Yeah, I know. He has a cat with a problem. I know. I just thought I tried calling you early, but your phone was not working, so I thought I'd bring that to your attention over the air.
I saw it. Thank you. Somebody sent me a link, and I saw it. But it was at the bottom of Paul DiRienzo's article about WBAI, which is about 97% truthful, I would say.
Yeah, that's a record.
That's pretty good.
I read that. Oh, also,
where did that appear?
The Villager.
Oh, the Villager. Uh-huh. I think that's been published for a long time, hasn't it?
Yes.
I think they were publishing before the Village Voice, except they were kind of folksy, and the Village Voice was more countercultural.
They were more, chintzy, the people would say. They had a column written by a cat, remember? Uh-huh.
I don't remember that, but they've been going since 1933.
Yeah,
they claim
it's like the old Waverly Inn.
Uh-huh.
You know, no, I haven't been at the new one. It's too pricey for me. But
what was I going to say? Oh yeah, well the Village is a much better paper than the Village Voice. The Village Voice is
but
a boring rag.
Well, the Villager is good. It's getting to be very good.
Yes, and they were good, or at least sometimes good, covering the Lower East Side. I can't give them full credit, but on some things they were. But anyway, Bob, I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good night.
And you're on the air. And you're on the air. Hello?
Hi, this is Cloudy.
Yes.
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are, on the radio.
Oh, okay. Hopefully I won't get hustled off too fast. But the difference between starting off, the difference between the erotic and the pornographic. Erotic is when it makes you get a woody. Pornographic is when it makes you come. So that's the difference. That's how you know the difference between them.
I don't think that's accurate.
Well,
yeah, usually, you know.
I'm going to hustle you off. You're too sure about things, Cloudy, and I wouldn't say that's a good definition. It isn't even funny. What good is a definition that isn't funny?
I wanted to talk about something different.
Well, it's too bad. You're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Paul. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hello.
Paul, I'm just curious. Is the was that DA in Liberty, or that actually would be the Sullivan County DA? Was that Carl Goldstein or Steve Lungeon?
Oh, I don't remember the name.
Oh, you never got to meet the DA?
No, I got to meet him, but I never knew his name. I don't remember his name if I knew it then. This was in like 1970.
Have been Carl Goldstein.
I honestly don't remember.
Yeah. Well, I'm really, really looking forward to your book. And actually, Bob, you can hustle me off really quickly, but I really have to play something for you just very quickly from WJFF.
We now go to New York City to join Bob Fass's Radio Unnameable on WBAI. He's got a studio full of people. Paul Krasner's on the phone. And for me and the whole WJFF family, we want to wish Bob a very happy birthday. He will be celebrating his birthday on Monday, June 29th. Happy birthday, Bob.
Oh, thank you. Liberty, thank you very much.
I don't know how she knows these things.
Yeah, how did they know?
Well, I guess you must have told her, Fred, huh?
I don't know. Probably a little bird told her.
Now it's gone viral.
Well, probably on the internet, yeah. You can find out stuff on the internet now that...
Right, Wikipedia, right.
Well, carry
thank
on.
You. Thank you. Thank you very much. But
you know, Wikipedia, you know who Sarah Davidson is? She's a writer, and she used to write... I'm trying to remember one book she wrote about the 60s that was popular, but she's a writer, and she wrote for Esquire a lot and other publications. And on her Wikipedia, somebody said, hey, you better check it out. It says that you're a national penis finder.
What?
And she was shocked because what she had put in was she was a national magazine correspondent or something like that. And so there's a place where you can change your Wikipedia, which you can edit it. And so she wrote to them making the change, and she said, and then you have to give a reason for and an explanation of why you're making this change. And she wrote, I am Sarah Davidson, and I am not a penis finder. So that justified her change.
Sounds like someone on Wikipedia. And
well, does she know who put that in?
Because I don't know. Can you find out?
Is it
traceable?
It's possible, yeah, I think, yes. And people can be...
The cops do it all the time.
Right. Huh. People can be barred from Wikipedia for stalking.
Well, and then they just use another name, right? Or their...
Right. Right.
A lot of romances like stalking.
You're on the radio. And you're on the radio.
Hello?
Hello, good morning.
Hey, Bob.
Good morning.
It's Joe.
Joe, hi. Good morning.
How you doing?
Okay.
I haven't even been listening for the last few minutes because I was trying to call you before and couldn't get through, but I'm surprised I got through now. Good.
Well, what did you want to ask Paul something or say something?
Well, it was just interesting, some of the things that he was saying. I actually had just mentioned Michael Jackson to somebody today. It was so weird. Something about him came up, and the person just said, he just died. They just said that today. I said, get out of here. No way. And then they said it, and I said, God, he must have such a sad life, this guy, to be so crazy. And I think Paul gave some of the details there. I mean, you knew an incredible amount of details about him and Lenny Bruce, about their lives and demise. Like you studied Lenny's a bit there.
How are you doing, Joe?
I'm okay. Getting home a little late tonight, but...
You still working as hard?
Yeah, usual stuff for a Thursday night. It's an excuse to stay up and listen to you, Bob, that's all.
You want
to
say what it is you do?
I'm a physician.
And you work in an emergency room on...
some nights. Not Thursday nights, it's my office, though. But, the drugs are interesting there, Paul. I mean, you really seem to have a heavy interest in them. Like you were really tripping during the Chicago trial, really?
Yeah, it was my period of psychedelic macho. I would just, Tim Leary always talked about set and settings were very important. But I would go in the subway while tripping. But I wouldn't get on the train because I like to sit in the bench and watch all the footsteps of the people who ever got into trains at that station just keep on moving. Even after the train left, so I did it at the trial, yeah. But it was it might have been foolish, but I thought I would regret it if I didn't do it, so I did it.
Well, the trial was foolish.
What was foolish?
The trial.
Yeah. I mean, I rationalized that I was doing the appropriate thing, but so it's hard to say whether I regret it or not. But because I, you know, I didn't, because Abbie Hoffman also told me, he said, you know, we have to have you testify because we've all testified that you were at these meetings, and so you have to verify this. And the thing was, I felt like I was having a history exam, you know. When did Napoleon decide that he would scratch his chest for the photographer? I really wanted to write down the chronology of what happened in Chicago, so I could have it without having to memorize it. But the implication is that if you have to write it down, then it really didn't happen. You're making it up, and so you have to memorize it.
Well, wait a minute now. Lots of times I've seen police on the stand take out a notebook and say, for the doctrine of assisted memory.
Well, that's what I should have done. I should have done.
No, you did the right thing, I think, Paul.
Oh, okay.
I think it was, you should have thrown up. That's the only thing that was wrong with what you did.
Yeah. And, you know, I did the first Twitter before there were Twitters, when there was a House Un-American Activities Committee. We're the only country that has that. You never hear about the Canadian.
Un-Canadian. I think there is something, actually. Or there was something like that.
Oh, yeah. I think they don't have HMOs there.
Right. It was one of those things.
So it was agreed among a bunch of us. This is when they were investigating something about national security. I forget what. But the point is that a bunch of us agreed we were going to stand up to protest the injustice of this witch hunt, is what it really was. But I was there as a reporter, and I'm taking notes on my pad. But when that signal came, I stood up, and I was the first one carried out by the marsh. Two big marshals, huge guys. They carried me out by the armpits, but my arms were free, and I was writing on my pad saying, "I am being carried out now by the marshals."
What a dedicated reporter.
Yes.
Now, that should have been in the movie of Chicago 10, Paul.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of stuff that should have been in. But, you know, it was the director's
You wrote a few scenes that were left out. You're famous for writing about things that were left out of things.
That's true.
You wrote about what was left out of the Warren Commission report, and you wrote about what was left out of, well, let's see,
In the book, Who's to Say What's Obscene is left out. There's two things. There's what the parts left out of Barrett, and the parts left out of Chicago 10.
Well, what were the parts left out of Barrett? This was not Barack Obama, but Barrett, who was a very transgressive and incredibly funny comedian, who has recently. In his guise of, Rupert? No. He has one of his characters is a German punk journalist. You know the character that I'm talking about? Who landed on Eminem during the Grammy celebration?
Yeah, and he was, except for his wings, he was kind of naked.
Right. It was almost completely naked. Right?
You should say you're talking about Sacha Baron Cohen.
Sacha Baron Cohen, Barrett. Right, but what are the parts that were left out of Barrett? In your book.
I'm thumbing through the pages now to see what's appropriate for radio. Let's see. I know that there's a chilling effect that, let's see. I don't want, let's see. I'll tell you what. Let me read something else that I start. I was going to read before when you said, "Do you want to read anything else?" And there's one little segment here that I think is relevant these days. So I'll read that instead. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This, Steve Allen once observed, "Comedy is tragedy plus time, but everything is accelerating. Even the rate of acceleration is accelerating. The time between tragedy and comedy gets shorter and shorter. The more news there is, the more victims there are to serve as setups for punchlines. On the same day that people were being burned alive in the fire at Branch Davidian in Waco, Texas, Jay Leno was turning the page. Jay Leno did a joke in his Tonight Show monologue about there being two kinds of cult members there, regular and crispy. In January 2009, on the same day that a plane crashed into the Hudson River, Leno did jokes about it, but since nobody died, that rendered the accident more acceptable as a source of humor. In September 2008, on the same day that the stock market dove 500 points and Hurricane Ike devastated Texas, Stephen Colbert said, "Thank God I have my money stashed on a boat in Galveston." In November, 10 days after the election resulted in revocation of the right to same-sex marriage in California, and while the fires in California were becoming increasingly catastrophic, Bill Maher, in his opening monologue on Real Time, acknowledged the seriousness of those spreading flames. "I knew it was a straight line, and I cringed with curiosity as to what the punchline might be." Quote, "But the fires could have been much worse," said Maher. "Gay people could have been married." "When it was first decided that a fence would be installed to prevent Mexicans from sneaking across the border into the United States, I was performing stand-up and announced that the government is now hiring illegal immigrants to build a fence that will keep themselves out of this country." Some months later, in December 2006, the Golden State Fence Company in Southern California agreed to pay nearly $5 million in fines for hiring undocumented workers, and the company's work actually included constructing part of the fence separating Tijuana, Mexico from San Diego, California. This might seem like satirical prophecy, but reality has long been nipping at the heels of satire. In fact, in the past several years, with ever-increasing frequency, reality has been outrunning satire. It wasn't a comedian who said, "There was a pair of dinosaurs on Noah's Ark." It was a creationist sincerely trying to reconcile the disconnect between science and religion.
Well, you're a conspiracy theorist, I think, you know.
Oh, and who's behind it all?
Well, you were instrumental in, I mean, there ought to be a better word, Paul, because you were instrumental in so many things. You suggested the name May Brussel to me.
I remember that, yes.
And
she was the queen of conspiracy research.
Right. And she was almost always, I mean, I don't remember anything that she was dead wrong on. Do you?
Well, I used to tease her about it. I say, you know, some people die and there's not a plot behind it. And I think some dentist in her hometown died that day. She said, "Okay, I'll give you that one."
I can think of one.
She got, you know, since things are known, even within the intelligence agencies, on a need-to-know basis, she got calls from agents who didn't know, except from hearing her, what some other branch of the intelligence agency was doing. So she had listeners from, it's like Mort Saul said that...
She might have been wrong about Izzy Stone.
Well, what did she say about him?
That he was a government agent.
Oh, yeah. No, she... I knew a lot of conspiracy theorists, researchers who, if people disagreed with them, even if they were fellow conspiracy researchers, they would immediately think that they were part of the conspiracy and were sort of you know, that they had infiltrated the profession. And so I learned to try and treat each issue individually and not assume, because one of the things that conspiracy researchers do is they start with a premise, and then they work backwards to fit what has happened into that premise. And
the president has been assassinated.
You sound like a district attorney to me.
well, few people,
you know,
I know.
It's just different. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of seeing reality and making sense of things that don't make sense. And you just can't generalize, because a lot of these conspiracies are true, and even if they're not true, the government is certainly capable of doing what they say. You know, back in during the Cold War, the Pentagon and the National Security Agency were discussing whether or not to have a plane disguised as a Cuban plane drop bombs on a ship, on an American ship, where Americans, among others, would be killed. And then
false flag.
That would be an excuse to invade Cuba.
It was the Northwood plot.
That's exactly what it was.
Well, how about that one, that ship they just were talking about, the Liberty? I had never heard about that before. Now, twice over the last few months on BAI, the ship in the 67 war was attacked by the Israelis, and it seemed like it was trying to get us into the war, but then it was quickly hushed up. All the Navy guys were totally threatened to shut up and say nothing. It took them 20 years to open their mouths. But it really seemed like they were trying to sink the ship, and then they could blame somebody and we'd get into the war or something, you know?
Yeah, oh yeah, no,
it's an obvious attack.
Remember the Maine?
I don't even remember the Alamo.
It seems like almost every war, other than World War II.
Remember the Bay of Tonkin?
Right.
Remember
down the list.
Saddam Hussein? Right.
Just don't say 9/11 yet, please.
No, I won't, but I wouldn't be terribly shocked to find out that there was more to it than we've been told. Shall I answer some more calls, Paul, or how do you feel? Are you?
I'm getting a little tired here because I've been working on the project. But
I can
feel
it.
We'll take a couple of more.
I can feel
it.
You're getting tired, Paul. You want to take a little break? Maybe slap yourself around a little bit, and I'll play a little bit of music or something.
No. Let's take a couple of more calls if they're there, and then I'll retire and fall asleep to the music.
Please don't retire, Paul.
Oh well. Tonight.
Well, if you want to call and talk to Paul and keep him up, telephone number is 212-209-2900. You're on the radio.
Bob?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for a dynamite show tonight.
Well, thank you.
And I can't seem to do this off like I can sometimes, but tonight I can't. It's just I am really intrigued and just getting so much out of it. I want to write down, how do you spell Paul? Thank you very much for staying up and staying on for so long.
Oh, sure.
How do you spell? I want to write down the name, your name, and the name of the book one time, if I could.
Yeah, it's Krasner, K-R-A-S-S-N-E-R. The book that Bob read from was just from the galleys. It's not going to be published until July. You can.
That's the
you
name.
Can reserve a copy on my website.
It's the name of the book will be the same.
Who's to say what's obscene? Politics, culture, and comedy in America today.
with it forward by a dial tone.
Oh, why don't you say your website, Paul?
PaulKrasner.com.
And you're on the air. Hello? Good morning.
Hello?
Hello, good morning. You're on the, you're on the radio. Where are you calling from?
The Bronx.
Oh, no wonder the connection is so poor. Well, thank you. Would you like to have any concluding words?
A question for Paul Krasner?
Sure.
Okay, Paul.
Yes.
You remember inauguration, Nixon's inauguration, in the tent afterwards when the Village Fugs played?
Vaguely, yeah.
And do you remember what you said to the audience about, well, here comes Cesar Chavez and the rest of you want to have an orgy, come with me?
I said that?
Yeah.
You sure it wasn't a guy named Super Joel who said that?
No, I know the difference between... Didn't you speak a little at that tent they put up? And they had strobe lights and...
Well,
remember that?
It's conceivable I said that, but
sounds like something you might have done, but it doesn't sound like something you would have said.
Well, in the tent, though, it didn't matter. That was like the beginning. It was so liberating that night, you remember?
Well, I remember that Super Joel invited everybody to take their clothes off. So you might be confusing me with him. I spoke too, but I don't. How could you invite a tent full of people to an orgy?
Because it was like one person, you know? It was like really.
Well, some orgies are casual and others.
Well, I
are
thought
intense.
It was funny because there was this political seriousness too about that day with Nixon, and it was like over, right? It was just total open. And we were walking down Pennsylvania Avenue smoking weed on Inauguration Day.
Yeah, this was the counter-inauguration.
Right.
Yeah.
And they didn't arrest anybody, you remember?
I guess. It's all vague, but well, we weren't violating any law, but that doesn't usually stop them.
Well, I was marching with the Freaks of Freedom. I had my face day glow painted by somebody. And you remember the cop?
Seems so quaint now, doesn't it?
Well, it was so alive. And, like, to me, it was the beginning. Like, Chicago was surprised for most people, but D.C. was, like, open. You know,
I think people knew what to expect in Chicago because, you're right, it had happened in other cities as well as Chicago before. You know, during the riots after Martin Luther King was assassinated, Mayor Daley then said, shoot to maim or kill, I think was his exact words. No, it was a really tumultuous time.
You're on the air. Oh, you're on the air, too. Hello?
Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
How are you, Bob? First of all, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
We'll see you Monday. Maybe the guys from East New York will see you. Tell you in person. The other thing, could I mention a parade on Sunday?
Why not?
Thank you. The Vets of Peace and the Abraham Lincoln Brigade will be meeting on 54th Street between Madison and 5th Avenue.
Oh.
At 11:30, 12 o'clock. Anybody wants to join us, you're welcome. And that's
terrific.
It for me.
I didn't even know there were still survivors from the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Well, it's ladies, it's the wives.
Widows, you mean?
We still have the... I belong to it myself, and I wasn't there much.
But I think it's terrific that they're meeting the vets of today. You know, they have that experience in common.
There was a wonderful article about Lorca in the New Yorker this past week. Did you see it?
I didn't see it in the New Yorker, no.
Lorca was a, to be brief, a great Spanish poet and playwright. Great Spanish poet and playwright. And he spent a lot of time in New York City as well. And he went back to Spain, and he was one of the first people that the fascists killed. And the author says that taken to a wall where they think that Lorca was shot, and she notices that the bullets are at waist level, and she said, "Well, these shots wouldn't have killed people."
Right.
And she's told, yes, but if they were kneeling. So it gives you an idea. Yes, a chill, yeah. Anyway, thank you for that that chill. It's getting warmer this summer. Thank you.
So, Bob, I'm going to turn in now.
Oh, Paul, well, I don't want to keep you up. I know you have to get up and take photographs with Nancy tomorrow. She's been sending wonderful pictures that she's taken in such varied places as campgrounds and roadside attractions. They're wonderful pictures, and I wish there was some way we could, you know, play them on the radio.
Well, I'll describe one, which is one of my favorites. We were passing one day, and there was a television set underneath a tree, and the captions are just give the icing on the cake. She captioned that one, "The End of Analog TV." And, you know, there are still people who, they may not get snow from the sky, but they're getting snow on their TV sets.
That's right. I haven't been able to get my government-issue DTV tuner to work.
Really?
Yeah, so I've been without TV. I can't say I'm completely... I would have liked... You sent me an email that said that Jim Ferrat, who was a fellow Yippie, was going to be on the Colbert show tonight.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did you see that?
No, that's on, that would be on now. I usually watch it the next day.
Oh.
Excuse me, Bob.
What?
Bob, Paul, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you got to ask Richard from East New York to come out and do that. He should be able to help you with that.
Help me with what?
Oh, Bob with his TV.
Oh, Bob.
Bob with his TV.
Oh, Richard.
This is Jerry from Sunnyside. All I need is people down there for the parade on Sunday.
Well, Jerry, thanks for telling us about it.
Okay, my pleasure.
I think you need a good antenna. That's where the money used to be made.
Yeah. Well, I spent a little bit buying an antenna. Anyway, has Paul said goodbye? Are you gone?
No, I'll say goodbye now.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Thank you, I just want to remind people that this book, which they should order now, and they can order it in advance from your website, which is PaulKrasner.com, is called "Who's to Say What's Obscene?" It's politics and culture and comedy in America today. I might want to read a bit more from it later on, if that's all right with you, Paul.
Of course it is. Of course it is. You are a good reader.
Thank you very much. And it's published by
City Lights Books in San Francisco.
Very prestigious house, as far as I'm concerned. Thank you
very
much.
They are. They're good to work with.
Thank
you. Okay, my friend.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, as always, and we'll do it again and again and again.
I hope
so. Take care, Paul.
Take care. Have fun, you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
And you're on the air. Hello?
How about the idea that the true owners of this country are... the bankers, is that a conspiracy theory?
I don't think it's a conspiracy theory, but it looks like it's obvious stuff. I don't know whether they're the true owners, but they're certainly the current, currently the people who are getting the most benefit from the bailout.
Perhaps in that case,
if you or I have trouble with our credit, we're not bailed out.
As they say, if you owe $25,000 to the bank and you can't pay it, you're in trouble. If you owe $25 billion to the bank and you can't pay it, the bank's in trouble.
You're on the air.
I'm sorry to call back. I just got cut off before, but I got all the information. I was just curious. I wanted to wish you a happy birthday, and I was wondering, are you going to do anything like with the station or anything like that for your birthday?
Well, my birthday will be passed by the next time I come here, but I don't know.
You're going to have a personal fun? Not public.
Hey, I'll be 76, you know.
Oh, that's great.
You can't really have that much personal fun. anyway.
I know you still got the fire in you, man.
Thank you, man. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, I got everything. It was so great tonight.
Thank you.
It was really great. Keep it up and happy birthday.
Thank you. You haven't heard anything yet. Thank you.
Just getting warmed up.
You're on the radio. Hello?
Hey. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Georgie.
How are you, man? Wow, beautiful show. Really nice to hear Paul. And sorry. I was trying to raise the bar, but that bar is pretty high. That bar, I think that is the bar. You know, of level of communication. Speaking of communication, I wanted to do the promo for KWMD in Krasilov, Alaska. I don't know the call letters.
That's
call
it.
Numbers.
KWMD. The numbers, I'm not sure.
Like your New York 99.5. You know,
right, right.
FM.
And you're listening on the World Wide Web.
Yes, I'm listening on the www Lake Michigan.
It's extra W there, I think.
But no, wow. Well, the banks own everything. We are slaves to the banks. I mean, face it, there's a ruling class and then there's us. And we're all buying and selling and trading in their markets. And the world needs to go on strike, man.
Right.
Everybody needs to go and stop working, stop producing shit. Excuse Oops. My language, I'm sorry.
I will
I'm
certainly. Sorry.
There goes Alaska.
Yep. You know, in Alaska, it's not the safe Uh-oh. Harbor yet. That was a terrible thing that you did, George, and you should apologize.
Please,
it just
forgive
came out
me.
Because you're drunk, right?
No. Yeah. No, not at all.
Okay, well.
But, I was.
You were what?
The banks own everything, don't they? Or they think they own everything on paper. You know, they've been shuffling paper for, like, you know, many moons, many eons, seems like. But, we need to be on strike. The world should just stop working, stop producing stuff, and get their attention, because they only feel it if they feel it in their pocketbook. And the pocketbook gets their attention. That's the language they speak, goldish. Diamondish or whatever it is, platinumish. They don't speak English, though.
Thanks, George.
You're welcome.
Hello. My name is Judy Gorman. Please come to a benefit concert for WBAI on Friday, July 17th at 7 p.m. It'll feature myself, Judy Gorman, the Ray Corona Band, the Mahina Movement, the New York City Raging Grannies and their daughters. at the Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church at 85 South Oxford Street in Brooklyn. Please join us. That we can do.
Must stand and face the hounds of hell and rot inside a corpse's shell. I'm gonna bring it tonight. Stenches in the air, the funk of 40,000 years, and grisly ghouls from every tomb are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver, for no mere mortal can resist the evil of the thriller.
Six feet down till you hear that coffin sound. You can weep and you can moan, that old boy ain't never coming home. Another man done a full go round, another man done a full go round. We can tell our tales, laugh and joke, ponder all day by the words he spoke. You can't run and you can't hide, death come creeping up by your side. Another man done a full go round, another man done a full go round. About this, a worm about that, taking out the dog or letting in the cat. Eat your biscuits, gravy, you can smoke and drink. Ain't gonna matter what nobody thinks. Another man done a full go round, another man done a full go round. Well, winter or summer, spring or fall, got to go when the good Lord calls. He made us laugh until we cried, and we never got a chance to say goodbye. Another man done a full go round, another man done a full go round.
Inspired by the great poet Charles Olson's poem, Maximus from Dogtown 1. It's off our second album. It's from the lines in his poem, "We drink or break open our veins solely to know." We drink or break open our veins solely to know, solely to know, solely to know. Hunger drives me onward to feel all of the skin, all of the skin, all of the skin. Hundreds of flashes cause us to feel the life in the sky, solely to know, solely to know. I want to know, I want to know, please let me know, I have to know, solely to know, solely to know. Flashes cause us to feel the life in the sky. I want to know, I want to know.
It isn't very well known that the same month that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, this other even more important find was stumbled upon hard by Masada by one of the Israeli archaeologists working in Cave 63. Lunchtime. Chaim Plutznik eating, has to relieve himself. He goes next door to Cave 64, tinkles. Why is a glint on the floor of the cave? He bends down and looks. Eureka! Another copper ruggler, an old rolled-up copper plate. It was the first national anthem. Mel Brooks deciphers the first line, but then difficulties. They take it to the Harvard universe. And here, now at last, after many years of scholarly hoarding and fistfights, the entire canticle, and by the way, it was carbon dated to January 12th, 2 p.m., 4004 B.C., a very fucking date. This is the hymn to nationalism. And we want to dedicate this to the Armenians and Azeris, the Sikhs and Hindus, Ukrainians and Great Russians, Jews and Arabs, Hutu and Tutsi, Greeks and Turks, Romans and barbarians, etc., etc., and really too much etc. It's a hymn to nationalism. Let them all go to hell except Cave 64. If they give you any trouble, throw them through the door. This is a cave, it's the best in the world. We don't want no foreigners, our cave might get spoiled. No, we don't want no walks here, our cave could get spoiled. I
a cave is the best. To hell with the rest. We got the prettiest girls, they never fail the test. That's the age test, I guess. We got the greatest music, we got the bestest brains, cause we always eat the cortex of the ones that we have slain. Yeah, we love the slippery matter from the ones that we have slain. Rooting comes natural to those that excel. The rest of you bastards, well, you can go to hell. God gave us power and God made us right. And if you don't like it, we'll stab you in a fight. Yeah, if you don't like it, we'll kill you in the night. Now it's another sing-along. Let them all go to hell except Cave 64. Let them all go to hell except Cave 64. They give you any trouble, throw them through the door. If they give you any trouble, throw them through the door. This is our cave, it's the greatest in the world. This is our cave, it's the greatest in the world. We don't want no wogs here, our cave might get spoiled. We don't want no wogs here, our cave might get spoiled. No, we don't allow no foreigners here, our cave would get spoiled.
Living like a refugee, it's not easy.
Yeah.
You see, I just took all the problems, the suffering of the people, and then make a song of it.
You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land. You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land. You will be confronted by strange dialects. You will be fed with unusual diets. You got to sleep in a tarpaulin house, which is so hot. You got to sleep on a tarpaulin mat, which is so cold. Oh, we on time.
Living like a refugee.
I'm now.
It's not easy.
It's really not easy.
Living like a refugee.
Not easy. Oh, we on time.
Living like a refugee.
Oh, nah,
it's not easy.
It's really not easy.
Living like a refugee. It's not easy.
To hear my solos. Franco?
Nah?
You don't get your supply?
Computer, don't forget me anymore.
Lord of mercy, computer again. Arayim?
Sir?
You don't get your tarpaulin?
Protection, not consider me.
Lord of mercy. Nature.
Nine.
You don't get your medicine.
Mama.
I said to see again. Get it to Kamara. Get it to Kamara again. Hey, get it to Kamara no day. Bolong pasa ibonam. Mohamed Bangura. Mohamed Bangura again. For the sister again. Francis Boyma. Francis Boyma again. You know the artists who go pass some. What am I saying?
You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land. You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land. You will be confronted by strange dialects. You will be fed with unusual diets. You've got to sleep in a tarpaulin house, which is so hot. You got to sleep on a tarpaulin mat,
with the Soko. Oh, we on time, living like a refugee.
Oh, nah,
it's not easy.
It's really not easy.
Living like a refugee. It's not easy.
Oh, we on time,
living like a refugee.
Oh, nah,
it's not easy.
We are
living like a refugee. It's not easy.
It's really not easy.
And speaking of the difficult, this is WBAI in New York City, KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and we are streaming, WBAI is streaming on the World Wide Web at WBAI.org. We're also heard over WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, and we can also be heard on their website, which is WJFF.org. So pass the word along and support WBAI. You can do that by going to that same website, WBAI.org, and pledging $25, which will make you not just a supporter of WBAI, but a member of WBAI, which will entitle you to vote in our very contentious elections. It's very exciting as we try to have more or less democratic governance here at WBAI, and we're struggling to keep it honest. $25 and you become a subscriber. $50 and we become a little stronger. $100 and WBAI might persist. You're on the radio. Hello?
Hello?
Yes,
Bob?
You're on the radio.
Oh, hi. George again. I just wanted to say, remember this beautiful station manager who came on, and or somebody manager from Pacifica, came in and said, like, if everybody gave $5, you guys would have so much money, you'd be rolling in dough.
If everybody gave $5,
why would everybody that's listening that can afford it? And just send in $5 addressed to, Pacifica. And, it would save the station in about a half hour.
Well, send it to WBAI. We owe Pacifica enough money so that we can
pay
them off.
Tell them where to send it, Robert, really, please. It's all you, WBAI in New York on 120 Wall Street.
Right. Send it care of Indira at WBAI 120 Wall Street. And I thank you, George.
Okay. New York, New York.
New York, New York.
Something.
That's right.
Blacksmith shop in the year of 56, while dusting out a tea plant that was out of fix. It bounded from the tongs and they revealed my doom. I am a blind fiddler and far from my home. Francisco operated on one of my eyes, but nothing could be gained. He says that I would never see, and there's no use to moan. I'm a blind fiddler and far from my sharing all my troubles, whatever they might be. I hope that they'll be happy while I'm condemned to roam. I am a blind fiddler and far from my home. Thank you.
this is Bob Fass. Last night, I had a really, like, unusual experience for me, and it was quite enjoyable. Some crazed people suggested that some people in the audience might be willing to pay a fairly large amount of money apiece to have dinner with some of the, us people on the staff or on the air at WBAI. And I went to a restaurant, really, incredible ambiance in this restaurant. You really, it's like if you don't look out at the street, you could be in some kind of, what I imagined anyway, a souk or a bar could be in South Africa. And the whole place is Nelson Mandela themed all over this place. There are pictures of Mandela, quotes from Mandela. And I wonder if this is what it was like after he left Robben Island. How did he live? Where did he go to hang out, if he did? Or could he hang out?
He came to Yankee Stadium, I remember.
Yeah.
And he, I am a Yankee, and he took off, put on the hat.
Right. Right. Well, he was really one of the first citizens, not first, but one of the great citizens of the world. And George Bush said that he's dead.
Oh, that's right.
Nelson Mandela.
I remember that part. Yeah.
Anyway, there was this dinner last night, and I got a chance to talk to Hugh Hamilton. I haven't had a chance to talk to Hugh Hamilton since right at the end of the very first coup. And I reminded him of this, not the first coup at WBAI, but one of our more recent coups, the one that resulted in the reinstatement of the people who have been couped out at the moment. Let's agree that democracy is a really awful way to rule a radio station. But as Winston Churchill said, it's better than any of the others, or all of the others are worse. I don't know how he put it, because I wasn't that big a fan of Churchill's, but every once in a while he'd take a sip of brandy and walk in on FDR nude and say, "We British have nothing to hide." And he was a big figure in a lot of people's lives. Well, Mussolini was a big figure. They were both big figures. They both ate and drank to excess. And Churchill more or less died in bed, painting. And Mussolini, as always seems to happen to fascists, had a deserved end. Hung up like a piece of beef. But somehow Nelson Mandela was able to make a kind of magic happen in the hearts and minds of his countrymen and women. And there wasn't the mass retribution that was so richly deserved. It was one of the first of the velvet ones.
Isn't that when we had the advent of the truth and reconciliation?
Yes, that's what Nelson Mandela managed to do, or at least maybe it was Tutu who did that. Maybe. But whoever did it should be awarded, like Pete Seeger, the Nobel Prize. Ray Corona is still here. Oh, Ray, thank you for sticking around so long.
I didn't want to miss Paul Krasner.
Are you there? I have the wrong. Sorry.
Oh, maybe I'm over here. I think they found me.
I'll give you both. Okay.
Okay. They found me somewhere. No, I didn't want to miss a show like this. I mean, how many times do you get to hear Paul Krasner talk about all those exciting concepts, both from the past and for the future?
Well, see, I'm one of the lucky ones. I have hours and hours of Krasner on tape and on digital, in digital format at the moment. And my database is coming along. And
how's your database?
In 8 minutes, Ibrahim Gonzalez and Ahmed Ali will be here with the wonderful In the Moment. But I just want to take one more moment to talk about how rare it would be the chance for me to meet Esther Arma, who was there. I didn't even have much chance to talk to her or to Kathy Davis, who was there, or to LaVon Williams, or the two listeners who did show up. I mean, they were both some of, like, they could not stop telling us how much they had to tell us about us and them. It was like one of those really intense meetings where people found out who each other was. There wasn't that much. It was difficult. You really had to lean in because the soundtrack in the place was loud, really loud. The music was good, but it was a little bit. It made talking a little. But this is some kind of a neighborhood hangout in Brooklyn. It was in Park Slope. I don't know, I got myself a Google map, and somehow I managed to get there, but it was at a place that was near where my grandmother used to live, and I didn't recognize the buildings. I did recognize a couple of the hills, going up and down the hills on... the way the land must have been. But who else was there last night? Oh, yeah. I mean, it's hard to believe the life that one of these people had. Either that, or he's the best prevaricator I have ever met. Orphaned as a child... I hope he doesn't mind my telling the story. I mean, I'm not going to give his name or anything. Orphaned as a child because of something violent that happened in his family and that was followed by arrests. And he went into foster care and was sent to a good school. And he was the only child of color in the school, and he excelled in everything, and he was admitted to MIT, which he turned down in favor of Dartmouth, because he said, if I go to MIT, I might be just an engineer, but if I go to Dartmouth, I can be a human being. And he's an orthopedic surgeon. And... one of the few things I remember about medicine is that orthopedic means walk straight. So I hope you all live an orthopedic existence. Until the next time we hear, Ray Corona was going to do another song, and somehow there's only a couple of minutes left. You can hear Ahmed Ali tenderly touching his guitar. How do you do? You're way off mic. You know that, don't you? But that is very nice. This is WBAI, friends, and we're happy that you're there. And I hope you're grateful that we're here, because we are. This is such an incredible audience. I mean, I haven't told you half the things about this guy. He flies a plane. And he was just sitting there across from us as though we were, you know, his equal, you know? And this is a guy who has... Interesting people in this WBAI audience. I bet there are other people who have incredible stories to tell. And here we have, on the brink of entering into your lives, we have Ibrahim Gonzalez, who has told you many interesting stories, and I hope will tell you many, many more. And Ahmed Ali, who is making the guitar do things that it didn't know it could do. Whoa.
Circus smile running wild, moonbeams and zebras and fairy tales. Ah, so she thinks about it. When I'm sad, she comes to me with a thousand smiles. She gives me free. It's all right. Take anything you want from me. Anything.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.